Hi everyone, welcome to another pod. Delighted today to have Angus Walker joining us from Hong Kong. Angus, can give a quick introduction, but he's, you know, worked as an investor in public and private for quite some time now. Some pretty interesting perspectives, given that he's living in Asia and has had a bit of experience in these markets that are now so topical. So welcome, Angus.
Thank you very much, Raz. What do they say? Long time listener, first time caller. Thank you. A quick background. As you can probably tell, an Aussie, been up in Hong Kong for the last 10 years and, you know, one of those kind of sickos who kind of picked up the investment bug very early and have kind of, you know, it's kind of the first thing I think about, last thing I go to bed. But, you know, really, really enjoyed the journey so far and, you know, still relatively early, but, you know, I learned a lot and have the scars to show for some. But equally, you know, now feel very comfortable, kind of found our niche of, you know, what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, perfect. So this was a pretty interesting week. It seems like it's been a while since we had earnings. But in some ways, it was almost the first crack in the chipmaker facade, in the sense that three companies reported earnings that I think are particularly relevant. It was ASML, Taiwan Semiconductor, and AlphaWave, which I don't think many people would be familiar with. But I know it's one of your favorite picks. Are you happy to explain AlphaWave and
why you like it? And look, I think if you liked it a lot last week, you'll like it even more this week because it's about 20 or 30% cheaper, is the old adage. The AlphaWave, I think, in my mind, is one of just these really, really great ways to play the whole AI thematic without paying, you know, 50 for a company and arguably, you know, growing quicker. So, you know, this is a company which is, you know, having spent a lot of time in the semiconductor space, is one of those more downstream kind of players, but, you know, a business which has really kind of robust kind of, you know, moats around it, where, you know, really stickiness around its IP. So it's more similar to like an Arm style business where their semiconductor licensing IP is what kind of customers come to. And, you know, it's a company that actually listed over in London, which I think with the benefit of hindsight wouldn't have been the best call because the expectations that were there that Arm were also going to list there. To have your largest peer listed in the same market's usually a good thing. Obviously, SoftBank kind of saw the dollar signs and went straight to the NASDAQ. So that didn't quite play out. But as they listed, you know, they're a really interesting business. They specialize in really, really high speed kind of connectivity between chips. And so if you've read about the kind of chiplet design structures, AMD's kind of core architecture, this is a really kind of like similar kind of IP business. You know, you've got to kind of first ask yourself why are we getting presented such a lovely opportunity at kind of single digit multiples. And you know, when they listed, they were kind of 50% plus of their revenue coming from China. You know, almost immediately upon listing, US started ratcheting up those kind of tariffs and so on the business, which really kind of sent people scared. The other kind of like key pieces about it was, unfortunately, they missed two audits in a row, which is basically, I think, for many, just red flag. I think, you know, digging into the actual nuance of it, they were really explainable kind of misses. The first was kind of a backlog of COVID, just where KPMG couldn't get, you know, about, I think it was 20 or 30% of the index reported their earnings late and were given, you know, everyone was kind of given grace for that. So when year two kind of comes around, you know, I think people are less forgiving. And that was, you know, really came down to them acquiring two businesses in, I think, the third and fourth quarter of that year. And, you know, these are deep kind of high intangible kind of acquisition, so not necessarily revenue generating immediately. And I think the auditor just really took a long time to get their head around such acquisitions. Ultimately, everything kind of cleared out and was you know, resolved. No, nothing untoward. But ultimately, I think what's created a really kind of interesting opportunity now, because it feels like it's really missed this whole semiconductor run. And you know, I think when you think even about Arm, you know, they're more of a legacy business where they've, you know, been in the game for a long time. So much of their book is around this 28 nanometer, pretty unsexy consumer electronics business, where AlphaWave is playing and specializes is 7 nanometer and below. And if you look at today's kind of bookings wins, it's really 5 nanometer, 3 nanometer. And even in the last announcement, they've spoken to 2 nanometer, which who knows how far that's off, but you know, that they'll be there and they've got a lot of patents around that technology. So I think, you know, one of the great trends, and, you know, I think defensively, if you think about buying something like an NVIDIA or an AMD, which, you know, I think you're seeing more of these large hyperscalers, your Amazons, your Googles and your Microsoft clouds. over time, they're looking to really bring in-house, you know, a lot of these chip designs. And, you know, they're never going to have a high-speed connectivity division, but they'll outsource to people like an Alphawave. So this shift of chips internally, I think, becomes a really interesting kind of tailwind for them as well. Google have been doing it for years with kind of TensorFlow TPUs, but, you know, we've seen AMD and Microsoft partner on their own cloud chips and things like that. So I think that's going to be a really interesting kind of thematic that plays out. But ultimately, you know, it's still early in its journey. It's got a lot of kind of large customer wins, and the bookings, you know, continue to beat. That ultimately points to like a pipeline in 2025 where you really get the revenue kind of inflection. So, I mean, this is a company, just to put some numbers around it, that is targeting $450 million now. It was 500 last week. But they've effectively closed their China business, which actually I think is a really helpful, what, you know, was considered a huge drag for it anyway.
This is what caused that 30% drop, was it?
Yeah, exactly. China business. I mean, yeah, I mean, what they basically did was went to a bunch of customers in there and basically said, look, we're going to normalize. It was lower margin kind of revenue anyway. They were going to normalize the business in terms of lifting prices. They kind of offered them all the new pricing structure. Most just said no. And that was kind of a bit of a, well, we're a bit indifferent anyway. So they just exited that. So in my mind, just kind of brought forward the ramp down of the China side. And, you know, ultimately these days in semiconductors and working with the large OEMs, you really have to pick a side, unfortunately, on the whole, which side of the fence you sit on.
Right. So this is a £1 billion company and they're targeting $450 million US.
Yeah, $450 million US revenue. You know, they'll do probably 20% EBITDA margins at the low end of their guidance there. So, you know, call it 90 in EBITDA 2024, and that's kind of, you know, underpins today's val, because you're trading at less than, or you know, around 10 times EBITDA, and you know, that looks pretty good. I think we see kind of, you know, and they've guided to you know, $1 billion of revenue only by 2027, which you kind of got to remind yourself is only 3 years away too. So, you know, and the other thing they did, I'd say, which, you know, got punished for, was two of those acquisitions. You know, they've become a more vertically integrated business, so they're now going down fully into the custom silicon. Without getting too much into the weeds, it's just a lower margin business, much better for their end customers, because you can do or more of a kind of turnkey solution on a whole process. But, you know, it just meant that their EBITDA went from 50% kind of margins down to 20 now, but they expect that to recover actually into the 30s again by 27.
Right, so roughly one time sales on the 2027 target with a 20% margin.
Yeah, and look three times EBITDA at that level, they're targeting 35% EBITDA margins, so 350 right. mil on a billion. You know, that's less than three times today's market cap. So when you've got peers trading at 80 times, I don't think that's the right multiple either. But, you know, this is just feels like a really good defensive way to play with AI. But, you know, it's dancing in the AI space, but close to the door in case it does kind of roll back. So things like this week, I see, is like a really great buying opportunity. And, you know, you don't want to make careers out of like running into a burning house. But, you know, I think if you understand the nuances of what they're doing, I'm more excited about the stuff which isn't even being produced today, which is going to be the real revenue driver in 2 and 3 years time.
Mm-hmm. And so who are the customers that are going to drive that? Are we talking Amazon? Are we talking?
Yeah, so Amazon has, I mean, they never name them publicly, but, you know, listening to enough of the earnings calls, and, you know, there's only really three kind of hyperscalers that you can refer to, and you kind of get a sense of who it is. So Amazon's definitely one of their big customers. Just this quarter, they've announced their first direct relationship with one of the world's largest automakers. So, you know, whether that's a, you know, GM or whoever, I doubt it's a Tesla, but, you know, it could be anyone. You don't get a great visibility on their own customers, but ultimately they're the tier ones of the world.
Right.
One other thing I think is important is the, you know, the founder himself as well has been, you know, in the industry for 30 years, well known by basically all the participants. He's exited his last two businesses to Intel, and I think it was Qualcomm for the second. And, you know, I think he doesn't pay himself a large salary, but up to his gills in stocks. So that's always kind of like a good sign of how he's going to get remunerated as well.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, you know, one of my concerns is you get in the weeds in something like semiconductors, where you know there's this huge wave of investment coming, probably the biggest CapEx build out in history. A worry I have is you get tied up, you try and be a bit too clever, go for small caps, when really it's kind of NVIDIA, Taiwan Semiconductor, you know, a handful of companies that will just end up capturing all of that, and with the strongest negotiating power. And they'll generally they might miss earnings every now and then. There'll be big swings, but nothing like what you'll see in small caps.
Yeah, you know what? That's been the last 3 or 4 years. It's been looking you in the face. It has been the Magnificent Seven that have done, you know, the legwork of all the index gains. But I think, you know, ultimately as well, there's, you know, you and I would probably much rather come up against, you know, less covered stocks with more retail or whatever it is, you know, create those kind of David Goliath mismatches as much as possible. And, you know, I think NVIDIA still actually does look cheap here to me if you actually are willing to forecast it out more than 3 years, and looks cheaper than most of the, you know, other semiconductor players. So I think actually that's a great buy too. It's kind of how do you pad it around the edges too. So I don't think it's you only buy one.
Yeah. But I think it's interesting, like, you know, NVIDIA's trading, say, 27 times forward PE. But the one that sticks out to me as being particularly overvalued is ARM. I mean, that thing's trading astonishingly high. It's not growing somehow. I mean, they're involved in NVIDIA's next generation. So there's a bit of excitement around that. But it's way ahead of everybody else without...
I think it's changed.
You know, that is the 100 times PE. That one is 100 times PE.
And I think it's changed since the IPO, but it's 70% of their book is actually very legacy old kind of stuff that's, you know, royalty businesses, once they start producing the chips, they basically clip the ticket every time. But so much of its backlog is actually old world kind of stuff. So there's a new sexy part, but it's a very small part of their business today. So I totally agree. I think that kind of comes down to SoftBank still owning, you know, 90% of the business. So, you know, really tight free float. I think it's like, you know, it was such an obvious short, and I would have like burnt, you know, I unfortunately don't short stocks, but you probably would have burnt, you know, 50% upside because it just continued to rip and it was almost too consensus a short. So I think still that comes down, but who knows on what time frame.
Yeah. I feel like after that kind of 100% rip after last earnings, that was probably the moment to short if you were doing that kind of thing.
You just broke everyone else. Yeah,
go long NVIDIA and short ARM at 5 times the multiple with none of the growth. That the only exciting thing about it is its relationship with NVIDIA.
That's it. And you've probably got an eventual seller in ARM as well, in SoftBank as well, right? SoftBank. You know, they're not natural owners of 90% of the company, so definitely more to come.
Yeah, there was another one. So ASML reported, and they missed. Particularly on orders, I think spooked the market. But it was kind of a weird one because they had such a blowout orders last quarter. You know, it went from 3 to 9 billion or something. You know, it was a huge outlier in terms of the order book. So these are very lumpy purchases. So it's quite likely that a lot of that was brought forward in that quarter. And they're still maintaining their guidance. So they're still forecasting a pretty blowout back end of the year. That could change. But I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, I think you touched on the big piece. It's like, you know, these ASML sells in single units. I mean, it's not whether you sold, you know, 10,000 or 20,000. It's kind of like, did they sell 42 or 44 of these kind of machines in a given quarter? So super lumpy whether one of those kind of comes in and lands on a day. I mean, things like talking to other people in business, that actually a pet food company here in Hong Kong, who's just a friend, you know, he's been massively delayed through these kind of canal issues through the Middle East. So, you know, things like that, if you get into the weeds of actual revenue recognition, could really play out for a company like that. Ultimately, you know, spend a bit of time talking to them. You know, it's a really supply constrained business. They sell as much as they can produce. And, you know, but it means because the componentry is so niche, you know, one, you can only move as fast as your slowest component, kind of like the Tesla issue from about, you know, 4 years ago. But, you know, one little kind of producer that can't bring this tiny little, you know, one of their contractors literally just helps them turn over the semiconductor extremely precisely from one side to the other. You know, if they kind of hit headwinds or something like that, the whole shebang comes to a bit of a grinding halt. So,
The other thing I noticed in their last report, it's probably because sales were down, but the proportion that went to China was particularly large, was 49%. And this is in the context of them not even being able to sell their high-end equipment to the Chinese. But I just think it's just like this massive policy-owned goal by the West, particularly the United States, to kind of kneecap these companies and foster, you know, the Chinese are going to react, right? They're obviously spending enormous state resources trying to recreate ASML and all the other companies in the supply chain.
And they've just brought that forward so far. Like, I mean, as it's such a known goal, I think so defensive. And, you know, the best thing they could have done is just fostered more development at home and just created a massive lead. But I think by the time, you know, there was such a reliance on these companies, and what China's definitely realized is that you've got to pull that forward and we need all that capability in-house. And, they'll get there, trying to kind of get a roadmap, and they actually hit the targets. Like, you look at their space exploration, you know, it's boom, boom, boom. You know, they can actually, you know, they take really long-term views on this stuff, which is, you know, one of the shortcomings of kind of Western democracy, is that you've kind of got, you know, election cycles, so you don't really care too much about getting past those pieces. These guys are thinking in kind of multi-decade, you know, time frames. So they've let out the tiger, I think. So, you know, in a few years' time, it's going to be really interesting to see where the balance of power sits on semis.
Yeah, definitely. It was a bit of a crack, though. It was the first kind of crack that was not consistent with the thesis of immense demand.
As you know, we've looked at this, though, right, together. It's, you know, if you look at somebody like Microsoft, and I forget the headline numbers, but, you know, how many data centers they're looking to build by 2028. Do you remember what that was? Is it 800?
Yeah, so this is just one source working at Microsoft who is involved in these decisions. So they've got 192 data centers now. They're refitting them all out, or many of them out, and they're targeting 800 by 2028. So fourfold increase, you know, well over 100 a year. And their prior plan only a few years ago was to build 100 over a decade. So it's almost like a tenfold increase in a few years.
Yeah, you just go, what am I doing buying AlphaWave? Just buy NVIDIA.
But it's Taiwan Semi, it's the index, it's the whole thing. But I guess in the price cycles, there were those smaller or rather mid-cap people who owned the niche, like KLA, and there are a couple of niche performers that did exceptionally well.
The KLAs, like the duopolies, like they are really defensive and robust. I mean, you know, there's a lot of know-how that sits inside these businesses, and, you know, they are important cogs and pretty invaluable. So if you can find those that, you know, I think AMD actually made a really important acquisition a few years back of Xilinx. And, you know, this was a company like 80 to 90% market share in the kind of laser kind of technology that they used. I mean, these are kind of still really interesting ways to play it. And you know, back to the AlphaWave piece, and then I'll stop. But you know, they were like, you know, TSMC's top high speed connectivity partner for 3 years running. You know, work directly inside the kind of sandbox there, and so have a real front run. So, you know, they're the kind of pieces you definitely want to see. You don't want to kind of rely on somebody out competing the other.
Yeah, well, Taiwan Semiconductor reported yesterday as well, so that was kind of an interesting. And that beat on income and revenue. Shares were down about 5%, but I think it's partly in the context of a huge rally up to it. But it does kind of give you a sense of where the positioning is. You know, everyone on podcast is talking about semis. You know, it's just one of those things where it's gone to, like, everybody has to own, everybody has an opinion, everybody's learned about all these companies, everybody's read that book, Chip War. You know, it's just that moment where it's gone from everybody writing them off.
No, I think you're bang on. And people forget, I mean, I'm a huge kind of realist around semiconductors will remain a cyclical business. And not that I think we're anywhere near the tip of the cycle. Like, you know, people can't produce enough of these things still at the moment. But they are physical products too. So you can't just ship at any kind of scale. You know, TSMC has still got huge kind of capacity constraints around, you know, how much to build of, you know, of each piece. And, you know, naturally they'll try and build as much of the, you know, new world pieces as they can, because that's the highest margin. But, you know, they've got relationships to manage at the other end, and, you know, they can't kind of let all that fall by the wayside either. So, you know, I think staying realistic that these things are cyclical business is important, probably on a, you know, over the next few years. And then just remembering that in each given quarter, despite demand being through the roof, they still can only ship so many. So, you know, earnings are always a great kind of bring back the, you know, sell the news kind of you know, measure. So, you know, I'd be kind of happy to own this outside of the earnings periods, and, you know, probably try and be a bit lighter going into most of these things. But then, you know, you've seen NVIDIA come out time and time again and just kind of, you know, when they beat that, you know, that quarter kind of a year ago when they just beat by 50% on the top line, just like a business that size just doesn't happen. So you can, you'd miss some of those big opportunities too, but, you know, probably cap some downside.
Yeah, definitely. Another interesting thing on the cyclicality is, I think if you add up all the government subsidies, it comes to $200 billion. So you could see a world where that actually helps drive some oversupply in a couple of years when you have these enormous government subsidies coming in. It's kind of mitigated by the fact that governments are also building their own data centers now. They want to host defense and important industries, the AI models, like internally on equipment they've like thoroughly inspected that isn't going to an American cloud and hosted in the United States. So there are positives to the government, what the governments are doing around the world. And I think that's actually new. I think the amount that they're spending is really substantial. It's like effectively a massive new customer for NVIDIA where they might not have been there before. But in any industry, when you have government coming in, spending huge subsidies, generally you get oversupply, certainly a lot more supply than you would have, you know, without that $200 billion of cash. And that's across EU, China, Japan, US.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think ultimately cyclicality happens because people build and then pause and then kind of reassess. And those pause moments are the ones that get you. You've also then got, you know, you touched on it earlier, like the China piece. Firstly, that's going to be competition of new players actually coming to the market. And then they're not just going to serve the domestic Chinese market. They will be exporting to the world as they're doing with EVs and crushing that. I mean, I really look at the EV industry as a really good, you know, space of Tesla had such a runway. Where's China just come from? BYD's just taken over Tesla in volumes, and there are about three or four, you know, companies behind them looking at doing, you know, similar kind of specs. And, you know, they're coming in and they're just so price competitive. Ultimately, I think the narrative that a Tesla is this ecosystem that drivers love and use is similar to an iPhone. I don't think that's the thing. You know, cars are ultimately an A to B, and when the price differential is so large, I think there's no amount of kind of ecosystem stickiness that kind of helps you there. And then, you know, I think that because of the China sanctions, you've seen a massive pull forward where they've been over ordering today and, you know, probably still getting away with, you know, circumventing some of those regulations. So how much of the actual supply chain has been over ordering, which, you know, eventually normalizes too, is really kind of important. You know, the same thing happened in crypto where everyone was buying GPUs and then suddenly crypto fell and they were just flooding the market with second hand. Nobody needed to buy a new GPU for a while. And that, you know, that's kind of not going to play out again. They've removed all the kind of mining capability from most of their GPUs anyway, but just a good kind of reminder.
Yeah, definitely. I think at the moment, the demand is still there. So the Microsoft person we were speaking to said, you know, they're opening a data center every 3 days. It takes a while to build, but every 3 days there's a new one opening and they're at full capacity in 3 to 5 hours. So there is that customer demand where crypto was always, other than, you know, store of wealth and the payment stuff and being a great place for anybody in any troubled zone, whether it's Russia, China, Middle East, to store wealth, you know, people build apps and no one really came, you know.
Yeah, totally. It's really not played out of the app. But yeah, no, none of us really have a daily use case for using it today. And so ultimately, I can see the store of wealth side and understand that. The rest, I think, is you know, probably a lot of smoke.
Yeah, I found it amusing to see in Canada has all these restrictions around bank accounts. You know, when there was tracker process, they made people hard for people to access their accounts. Now, apparently, you have to have a reason if you withdraw cash. So you can't necessarily just go into the bank and withdraw all the cash that you have.
It's actually, I mean, I think this is the real kind of own goal that's, you know, driving, you know, really reinforcing this, you know, but of course, you know, you've seen so much like cyber issues, probably like everyone's grandmother's probably been, you know, semi-Nigerian prince at some point. But the, you know, I think ultimately the banking system as well is, you know, people are really learning now more than ever that you don't just have access to your money. Like you really get questioned whether you're, you know, anything in cash is basically, you know, it's almost what India did where they really tried to kill the cash economy and move everything towards, you know, these payment systems. But even just trying to get anything over a few grand out of the bank account, there's like so much process around it. Moving money internationally is just near impossible. And, you know, this is even back between kind of tier one places like Oz and Hong Kong. It's just, it kind of beggars belief.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that was interesting this week is Eli Lilly came out with a long-awaited study. I'm not sure if you've been following it, but, you know, from mid to late last year, there was a huge sell-off in all kinds of medical technology companies as, you know, these GLP-1 drugs or GLP-1 drugs seem to have, like, an extremely positive effect across the heart, you know, kidney, liver. But one that was particularly widely anticipated was this sleep apnea, which forms the basis of some very large companies, including ResMed in Australia. And they finally released the data, and it kind of showed about 60%, almost two-thirds reduction in sleep apnea amongst obese people. So you've got another large medical condition that these drugs just seem incredibly effective for.
Yeah, I mean, that you know, I remember watching it because I haven't followed ResMed too closely, but, you know, it was kind of big headlines when it hit. So it was like too intriguing not to look at. Sent the share price down, you know, about 30% pretty quickly. I think what you actually then ended up saying, and this is why it's so important, like falling into narratives can be really, really problematic first up, because actually, you know, they would argue, and, you know, I think the recovery of the share price kind of is proving right that actually, you know, sleep apnea, and their thesis generally has been that this is a super underdiagnosed condition. So 20%, these aren't correct numbers, but 20% of the world might have it, but only kind of 2% get diagnosed. And actually what this was doing, so people that wanted to actually get Ozempic and were, you know, suddenly flagging sleep apnea as their excuse, you know, this was actually bringing them first into, you know, GPs that would force them to do it, at least do the sleep test. So a short-term tailwind for the stock. And, you know, that there's so many kind of, you know, flow-on effects of like so many of these pieces. But ultimately, you know, I think you're right. Like, this isn't great for their end market. And if sleep apnea can be treated rather than managed, then they've probably got a longer-term issue.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. It's definitely another line of treatment. We often looked at a stock that basically had a surgical treatment for sleep apnea called Inspire. And it was kind of a pretty good performer, but it got absolutely smacked last year. But then for all those kinds of players are like second, third, fourth year, fourth line treatment, you've just got another line, you know, you just got another thing that people are going to try. So it definitely does weaken the market, but it's very positive for everybody because, you know, as you say, sleep apnea is very underdiagnosed and it's surprisingly correlated with all kinds of negative health consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. The, I mean, it's just poor sleep, right? Everyone suddenly read Why We Sleep and, you know, suddenly I've got to get my 8 hours. You know, that was almost, it used to be almost bragging rights about how little sleep people, you know, CEOs used to say they got. Now nobody really kind of, I think people just think, hey, poor you, you idiot. So that's quite.
I think there's something fundamental going on. Like, if you think about it, every sentient or every animal that, you know, thinks has to sleep, there are no exceptions. Mm. There's literally no exceptions to that. So why, like, evolutionary, that's such a bad thing to have to just knock yourself out and be unconscious for, you know, a third of the day. So why do we all do it? Like, it must be deeply fundamental to how we think, how our brains work. Obviously, it's been established that it's very useful for memory formation as one thing. So you wonder if maybe, like, you know, the large language models in our head that are predicting what we're going to say next and saying it. You wonder if that's like when they're kind of taking their training time to kind of prune the kind of memories and decide what's important, what's not, which neurons strengthen. And it there's not enough energy perhaps to kind of do that at the same time. So you have to switch that system over from, you know, consciousness to training mode.
Elon Musk chip implants in the brain, right? It's just, I mean, ultimately this like tin hat kind of coming on here, but you know, the real fear is that humans are actually the biggest latency to progress. And, you know, we do take 18 years of heavy social conditioning to have it beaten into us, like how to act normal and think. And, you know, that I can't see how you can, you know, maybe take 10 or 20% off that, but, you know, it can't keep up with the rest of the pace of growth. And I'm kind of one of those people who actually think, you know, is growth even good in the first place? But we're on such an unstoppable path. You know, it's certainly, it's a worry.
Yeah, well, if you think about how our brains work, they kind of like take a long time to train, but they're incredibly efficient by a factor of like 1,000 versus, you know, a computer.
You've got more medical pedigree than I do, but Ozempic and, you know, the GLP-1, this just seems like the first time in history that we've had this, you know, wonder drug. I mean, I've always believed and you know that ultimately, you know, you need some level of self-discipline and things like that to stay healthy, and you know, lifestyle is kind of the biggest impact. But ultimately, you were just suddenly, everyone's kind of learning this really bad like lesson that actually there's a drug that kind of solves all. Do you think this is going to be this wonder drug, or we just don't know what the kind of 10 and 20 year side effects will be, or maybe other
look,
other
I think it's shown a few things. So there's parts of it that are very well established, you know, the way it slows digestion, the effect on blood sugar, that's all very well established. The stuff on how it affects your brain and why people are drinking less, apparently having babies more, but you know, gambling less, that is less well understood. In terms of like a wonder drug, there are plenty of people that were saying, you know, a lot of diseases are metabolic, right? There's a lot to do with like blood sugar and those blood sugar spikes, and actually that was causing all kinds of trouble. And you can see it, right? You can see it when people are kind of old, overweight, tired, skin's terrible, you know, all kinds of health conditions happening at once. This kind of like is really strong evidence that that is a major part of it, because you're kind of fixing that metabolic side or improving that metabolic side and then having positive impacts on almost every organ that you can see, you know, right? It's,
yeah.
There were some promising results in Parkinson's, you know, it's not just kidney, liver, heart, and obviously well. So I think it's an immensely positive thing. I'll say another thing, like if you do the numbers, you know, if you have an extra like mouthful of food every day, you'll be obese by the end of the year. Like the difference between being slim, 70, 80 kilograms and being 100, 110, 120 is really narrow when you think about it, if you just look at the numbers. And the reason for that is we all have these internal things that balance everything out. You know, you might go for a very long run, then you might lie on the couch and eat a bit more. You know, somehow our bodies are like really good at this is like level that they tend to maintain, and you're regulating, and it's really powerful effect. And this seems to kind of just readjust that down. So yeah, I'm pretty convinced these are good things. I mean, could there be something, you know, 20 years down the track? These drugs have actually been in the market for decades. So there have been very large 10-year studies which showed all these health benefits. So the question is there something that turns up at 20 or 30 years? But then you're starting to get to the point, well, you know, if you have better health for 20 or 30 years, it would be a real surprise if something came up that was in any way, you know, not overweighed by those immense health benefits of the 20 or 30 years before.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, it's the homeostasis piece, like the self-regulation. I mean, maybe, you know, with absolutely no scientific kind of backer, you know, it'd be really interesting to see how people come off these drugs as well, and how, if there are any kind of impacts to the kind of rebalanced homeostasis, and, you know, if you're more predisposed to then put on weight, or if they are kind of, you know, once you're on, you kind of need to stay on that path and you kind of, you know, tied at the hip.
Yeah, well, I think people do just kind of go back to where they were, but that's fine. You know, it's probably more encouraging
that's
than
fine.
If people
were.
There's an interesting article that I think there's something to it, is it obviously changes your personality in some ways.
Are you a less interesting kind of funny guy and all that kind of, you know?
You definitely go out a lot less, you drink a lot less, you have less energy for that, less appetite for that kind of thing, which is great if you're trying to have less than four beers. Or like, you know, just go home at 11 instead of 2 a.m. or something.
You're living on your knees.
Yeah, what if you're on it for 10, 15, 20 years? Like, you're clearly going to be a different person at the end of that, having taken all these different decisions along the road. But, you know, maybe that's what you want. Maybe that's
you know, physical health is obviously so important, but I guess you want to be still kind of your own kind of person as well. So I mean, if it turns everyone into like half zombie like kind of, you know, it's just not going to be a very interesting place to be. So, you know, you might be in great condition physically, but you're kind of like not able to kind of like talk to somebody interesting and kind of attract the right person anyway. So
interesting. Yeah, I don't think anybody's
I don't think there's been anything
that's saying people are less interesting. And if you had to guess, you'd say you're probably more likely to attract the right person, you know, 10 or 20 kilograms lighter, but who knows?
Yeah. As Ozempic singles parties, that'll be the new...
Actually, that sounds pretty boring, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Probably prefer to party with the degenerates.
Yeah.
Why don't we wrap up there? Thanks for coming on. That was fun.